experienced by people and wildlife. Employing ethnographic techniques, it attempts to uncover and contextualise the cultural factors influencing such moves, situating these in relation to what I would describe as more than human attachments, memories, emotions, and affective encounters. So, historically, at least for Britain, conservation can be characterised as a rationalising project underpinned by a focus on science and heritage that reflects its colonial legacy. In its early modern English usage, during the practices of the 19th century, conservation broadly referred to the protection or preservation of existing conditions. This often involved the spatial demarcation of nature as wilderness, enacted in the form of protected areas and national parks. This fortress model of conservation has been widely criticised by post-colonial and critical feminist scholars for having violent territorialising effects on both human and non-human communities involved. And it stems from a uniquely Western need to categorise, organise and map a place and its inhabitants, tied up in the historical quest to know nature. So early classificatory systems, followed by 19th century evolutionary theory and 20th century experiments in population biology, have all had a tendency to construe creatures as bits of information abstracted from the worlds within which they live. As geographer Sarah Whatmore puts it, the multisensory animality of creatures all but disappears as they become symbolic and material units in some human currency. The latest and most far-reaching enactment of this empire of knowledge is the newly minted Science of Biological Diversity, or Biodiversity, which is now being promoted by a cadre of ecologists and biologists in the name of conservation. As a global science, biodiversity has made life quantifiable in new ways, accounting for and drawing public and political attention to the staggering loss of species, ecosystems, and genetic diversity. But as recent critics have noticed, biodiversity is a discursive concept, always caught up in value-based systems pertaining to particular people and places. In Van Doren's ethnographic study of the conservation of critically endangered Hawaiian crows, he discovers the nuances involved in protecting and caring for certain species, often at the violent expense of others. The rationalising project to preserve the rare and native is contrasted to the deep affection cultivated through prolonged encounter and so personal familiarity. What this demonstrates is that conservation decisions are almost always more than rational. They're infused with or simply overridden by other priorities and cultural preferences, many of which are to do with emotion, affection, and other forms of relation that go beyond knowledge of a species' conservation status. Geographer Jamie Lorimer hints at this when he identifies some of the ways that animals become subjects for conservation or of conservation, for example, through their ecological, aesthetic, or corporeal non-human charisma. I want to elaborate on this idea, but do so beyond conservation frames. And I think it's really important when thinking about urban spaces, because many of the inhabitants of these spaces do not hold a conservation status and are often characterised as common, non-native, invasive, or simply pests. So for the rest of this presentation, I'm going to talk about how I've tried to hear beyond the common categories of conservation as they appear in my study areas. And one of which I'll be talking about today. Whilst the aim is to better understand the complexities of doing conservation in urban peopled environments, I want to highlight how sense and sense making has been a key part of that process. So I'm going to focus on a reservoir system in northeast London, which is soon to be transformed into one of Europe's largest urban wetlands. Here I've been searching for what else is going on during species counts, habitat mapping, and the extraction and restocking of fish, sonically but also at a multi-sensory level, since, as ethnographer Sarah Pink points out, the sonic can never be entirely separated from other senses. So as part of these field investigations, I develop a version of the listening walk, which according to geographers Gallagher and Pryor can operate as a mode of inquiry, a form of intensified human sensory perception and a way of connecting to the more than human world. For me, the collective listening walk has revealed how listening is an immersive, visceral experience as well as a place-shaping exercise, which is something I'll come on to later. So as to not to entirely focus on the human experience, even as that experience becomes more than human, I did also use more traditional forms of field recording combined with simple observation, working with local bird experts, field ecologists, amateur naturalists, and those intimately familiar with the site, such as local anglers. And the hope was to find or to understand what it might mean to belong in this space and relate to it, not as a visitor visiting a nature reserve, but as a creature operating in and through the site and treating it as if on home turf, so to speak. So before I talk more about the approach and methods, I wanted to introduce you to the site itself. Walthamstow Wetlands, as it's now dubbed, is a reservoir system in London's Lee Valley, which is made up of 10 reservoir systems that supply London with over 30% of its drinking water. As well as being an operational facility since the Victorian times, it's a recognised haven for wildlife and an important site for anglers who have been fishing here since before the Second World War. It also sits in one of the most densely populated parts of the city, where very large housing growth is planned, and was identified in the GLA's London plan as an area deficient in access to nature. So at the turn of the century, the wetlands found itself at the heart of industrial development in Britain, powering mills, housing factories, and being the choice location for a new reservoir complex to supply London with clean, safe drinking water, which was much needed after the cholera outbreak, which killed thousands. But despite the kind of strong industrial mark of the wetlands, its story is not a simple one of progress in which humans were the only actors. History reveals a co-fabricated landscape that goes back millennia. Fossil evidence suggests that the local area was once part of a vast primeval mosaic of forests and marshes where wolves, ox, bison and elk roamed alongside early settlers who had farmed, hunted and battled since prehistoric times. In this way, we might imagine Walthamstow Wetlands as a place of patchy landscapes and multiple temporalities and shifting assemblages of humans and non-humans, what Singh calls the very stuff of collaborative survival. So throughout the years, a number of different bird species have made a home here, from those typically associated with marshland habitats, such as reed bunting, willow warblers and grey herons, to those more commonly associated with urban areas, pigeons, parakeets, Canada geese, mute swans, and now increasingly cormorants. Cormorants, also known as sea crows, would normally live on cliff faces, but they've come inland due to a lack of food on British coastlines. And here they seem to take full advantage of the regular restocking of fish in the reservoirs, which is much to the annoyance of some of the anglers itself. But change is now underfoot at the wetlands. In 2010, the local council managed to secure a heritage lottery bid to transform the site into a distinctive urban wetland reserve, offering improved access to nature, industrial and social heritage. Although the bid brought together a multiplicity of actors, striking the balance between conservation and transition hasn't always been easy. And according to one of my participants, it's required a cultural shift, because up till now it's been visited mostly by anglers and bird watchers, about 10,000 people a year, and in its new guise as a nature reserve, numbers are expected to be at around 250,000 per year. So in preparation for the public opening this autumn, conservation practitioners have been carrying out various aspects of habitat enhancement, including planting 2 hectares of reed beds to offer more protection to wading birds and encourage certain species to the site, such as the bittern. And similarly, they've redesigned the chimney of the old 1800s engine house, which I can't see on this, the idea is to put in swift boxes in with the other bricks to encourage swifts to come. And one manager explained how this swift tower for her symbolised the transition from the industrial to the ecological, a sign of our times. So you can imagine the kind of soundscape here, neither typically urban nor typically rural, but a sonic assemblage of multiple creatures performing multiple functions. To make sense of these changes, both the cultural and ecological shifts, as well as the experience of human, plants and animals as they go about their lives alongside or in spite of the conservation process, I decided to dedicate most of my field work to various practices of listening. So I'm going to transport you to the wetlands sonically. See if this technology works. Right. You might want to close your eyes to get into the listening mode. So in this recording, you really get a sense of the movement and distance of bird sounds, like the geese flying overhead, and the intensity of some of their calls, and maybe you can tell it was mating season. There's also the closeness of the reeds as they rustle in the wind, and you might have heard the crackling of my paper from my notebook, because for me it wasn't about getting a pure sound of nature as a wildlife sound recordist might. I was more interested in the distance, intensity, duration and movement of sounds, but also how my presence sounded as well. So this research is interested in revealing how soundscapes are inherently hybrid things, and that there's always a listener or hearer. Recalling Haraway's contention that knowledge is always partial and incomplete, the hearing subject is a situated subject in this instance. So in the recording I played just now, the distance of sounds and the movement of sounds reflect the situatedness of the listener, and that is part of its truth. Historically, the natural sciences have emphasised visual observation and abstraction as the truest form of perceiving the world. Naturalists would abstract single components of a larger context in order to identify, quantify and categorise individual elements and organisms, such as the case with doing transect lines and square grids. But according to bioacoustician Bernard Krauss, exploring habitats sonically reveals how human territories are much more fluid and amoeba-like things than traditional visual representations indicate. The emerging fields of bioacoustics and soundscape ecology try to incorporate all the elements of a given soundscape in order to fully understand the oral expressions and dynamics of a biome or habitat. And for me, this means finding ways to reconcile observations, sonic or otherwise, with the subjective experience of being in a given environment. And in his book, Wild Soundscapes, Krauss finds that the goal of the listener recorder is to read the stories embedded in the natural soundscapes. And while this may be a noble feat, it says little about the listener recorder and his or her own embeddedness in the process, or the process of becoming embedded within the natural soundscape. And in fact, the very idea of natural soundscapes refuses any such possibility. Instead, it works to reinforce the myth of wilderness, which has long been criticised by feminist and post-colonial scholars. And in a similar vein, soundscape ecology tends to frame human sounds as noise and noise pollution, which not only re-entrenches nature society dualisms, but it does a disservice to the many animal inhabitants who now find better access to food and shelter here, nestled amongst human populations, than in the rural countryside. So in today's post-industrial Britain, the wilderness ideal is somewhat unimaginable, and new conservation territories are emerging, many of which feature nature-society hybrids, either by incorporating human recreational needs or being situated within human communities and urban zones. Walthamstow Wetlands is one such territory, where different, more hybrid understandings of its sonic ecology is perhaps needed. So recently I spent a day at the wetlands with Dave, who's a local expert and wildlife sound recordist. I arrived at the wetlands and Dave is already prepared and waiting, map and notebook in hand, bins around the neck, logging into his mobile app, which will record the species we see and hear during our walk. He's here to count the nests of breeding herons and cormorants, and he has everything one might expect to see of a scientist in search of the objects of his study. But after about an hour into the walk, I realised that I haven't seen him record these species once, and I mention this fact and he tells me that he logs things quickly so that he could just get back to listening. On several occasions, as I'm asking questions about bird numbers and bird behaviour, he abruptly cuts off the conversation and cocks his head from side to side. And without looking in the direction of the sound, but keeping his ears fixed on it, he starts what seems to be a stream of consciousness directly coming from his listening experience. There's a blue tit over there. There's a robin here singing as well. There's a car coming towards us in the distance. And I can hear the difference between the grey-lag geese, because each geese speech has a different sound. And at the same time I listen to the sound, I measure the distance, because I'm onto that robin down there, just to the left of the pylon, about a metre from the tarp on the right-hand side, slightly. So during the walk, he's constantly alert and constantly searching, and then visibly and audibly in a state of anticipation and excitement when he hears something new. He tells me he works like a radar sweeping around, moving from sound to sound, while blocking out any interference, loud conversations or a fire engine or the whirl of traffic or the aeroplanes ahead. So although he's organising and cataloguing what he hears, he's doing more than just clocking these things. He's using his body to heighten his capacity to hear, sifting out whatever he needs to hear that specific sound. And I ask him why he moves his head from side to side. And he says, because on an owl they have one ear low and one ear high, so that they get not only direction, they get the height as well. And the more you change your head, the better you get at picking up where stuff is singing. And he goes back to moving his head like a turtle or someone nodding to a hip hop track. So alongside these science-based activities, there's also, or if you could even call them that, there's also recreation activities taking place. And the main one here is fishing. And not being familiar with this practice nor remotely interested in fish, I wanted to understand the in-situ experience of fishing and how such an activity might sit within a space that's being constructed as a nature reserve. So I spent a day with a local angler who offered to show me the basics. And when we get out of the van in a quiet spot, next to a large weeping willow, he passes me a rod and demonstrates how to thread the reel and make a tiny knot in the end for a hook. And we attach our weights, these tiny, delicate bolts, lead bolts pinned to the fine nylon rope. And he takes out the box of worms and threads the two carefully on the end. And I feel a bit nauseous seeing the box of pink things squirming and writhing across each other. And my face probably says as much, but he smiles somewhat sympathetically. And we cast our rods and take our seats on these plastic pop-up chairs. Then it's a beautiful sunny day, the reservoir's calm and the clouds pass reflections over the water. We sit there for 3 hours, occasionally talking, but mostly just observing. The idea was to keep half an eye on the red floats bobbing up and down, and a quick flash would signify a caught fish. And at first I found the silence uncomfortable, but when I looked across at Roger, he seemed quite at ease. And after a while, we normalised the silence. At the end of the fishing session, and we didn't catch anything, much to my relief, Roger packs away all the gear and he says, you know, there's more to fishing than catching fish. And he said, it's about the whole experience. It's about finding something within yourself, catching something within yourself. And did you notice how the wildlife was different with us? Coming closer like that rat. That's because when you're fishing, you set your intention on the float, and they sense that, the other animals, you give off a different vibe. You're not angry or stressed or nothing. You become camouflaged and you blend in. So So Roger seemed quite able to separate the quiet, tranquil experience. He managed to separate this experience, quite tranquil experience, from what was always on the horizon, which was catching a fish, and my tranquility was always disturbed by the image and sound of a fish struggling at the end of my hook. So although I enjoyed the birds and the other creatures that became part of our environment, just as we became part of theirs, I still felt out of place with a rod and hook in my hand, and I just couldn't quite reconcile the two ways of being in this environment. So in addition to trying to hear the different perspectives of user groups there, I also wanted to understand different visitors' experiences at the reservoirs. And so I organised a series of listening walks, kind of designed to elicit experiential data about ourselves as animal bodies and voices. So these walks were conducted in silence and involved various stopping points along the way, with opportunities to hear through headphones and recording devices. We started with earplugs in our ears, and this produced a really interesting responses when I invited people to talk about their experience at the end. One person said, "I really noticed my breath and footsteps with the earplugs in. It almost made my breathing change because I felt a bit self-conscious of how loud it was, but then I thought, oh, no one else can hear me." And another respondent said, "Yeah, I could hear my footsteps too, but I was wondering if it was the vibration of my body. And I had a scratch and I scratched myself and I could almost hear the friction of my finger on my face, and it was pretty odd." So it's interesting how plugging our hearing, becoming semi-deaf for a while, allowed for a more inward experience of our bodies. And that kind of reflects on the things we were talking about yesterday about the interiority, interior experiences. But I was also here to keen to hear what participants had to say about the environment as well and the space that they encountered. And one participant made a really interesting point about how her experience of things changed as she relaxed into the senses. She said, "At the beginning I was really trying to label the sounds, like what's that and what's that, really searching, and it was almost quite anxious, like I needed to know. But then that feeling softened as we went on." And this illustrates how cognition is such a dominant faculty. Time up.
Well, just keep finish up.
Okay,
finish.
From there, basically there. Sorry. So yeah, just these ideas illustrate how cognition is such a dominant faculty, and it somewhat sometimes overrides the sensory experience. We want to find names and labels for things all the time. But the comments show that it's possible to experience without words, to the point where, when it comes to describing the phenomenon, we have to improvise, as one lady does when she says, "It was cool to hear the wind against the metal, it was quite bassy." And another one said, "It was interesting to hear the fly fisherman going whoosh, whoosh," and she made that whipping sound. So I'd like to offer some early reflections on what's emerged from this sense-making process. Firstly, the walks themselves revealed how listening is twofold, at once an immersive experience and a spatial exploration of our oral territories. And Paul Rodaway hints at this in his book Sensory Geographies, when he says, "The sense both as a relationship to the world and the senses as themselves are kind of structuring of place and defining of space." So on one level, our own animality was brought to the fore, that is our existence as feeling and living, breathing things. And on another level, the objects we encountered, the plants, animals, materials, paths, buildings, became more than objects. They surpassed the names we could give to them and took on a life of their own. And this idea resonates with anthropologist Tim Ingold's assertion that spaces become places when they're experienced. So finally, I was just struck by the relationship between mobility and listening. And while I was still, some of the things around me seemed to have so much mobility, like sonic mobility as well. Even the reeds and the water seemed noisy. And then when I was walking, I felt loud and conspicuous, and the place itself then became a kind of background, flatter, like a landscape painting. And neither one of these states or ways of being is more authentic than the other. And I think altering the tempo and rhythm allows for different plants, people and animals to be experienced. So finally, I just want to say that, and this relates to my broader research question, there's a tendency to categorize animals, but there's also a tendency to categorize people, you know, bird watchers, bird watch, and fishermen, fish, and walkers, walk. But by taking time to really hear the lives and lively practices of these people, plants and animals, it's likely that we'll find there's a lot more going on. And incorporating these aspects into technical studies could go a long way towards defining the goals of conservation in more meaningful ways, offering important insights not only on animal spaces, but what geographers Farlow and Wilbeck call their beastly places. That's it.
Got about 15 minutes, is that right, Erica?
A bit less, just 5 minutes.